Hello and welcome back from another incredibly hectic week. We are live right now on X, YouTube, and Rumble. Or if you're watching this on the replay, this episode will be available on Spotify and wherever else you get your podcasts. If you like what we're doing and want to help us keep going, please hit the links in the description or visit us at ddgeopolitics.com. Really huge thank you for getting us to 375,000 on X and 38,000 on YouTube. So thank you, everyone, for your support and your subscriptions, followings. I don't know what to call them. Marat, how are you? Another crazy week.
Yeah, I'm doing well, thank you. How are you? Do you like my shirt? I'm wearing my Zelensky green.
Do you? You should have told me because I have a Zelensky green and I didn't realize it was Zelensky green until I wore it once. And then Aria was like, what are you wearing? It was like olive.
I realized as I was looking in the camera, I was like, wow, that's Zelensky green.
It's nice though. I also wanted to start a segment. I know Marat's probably not ready, but a segment about maybe what we're reading because we're both huge nerds and we read really kind of obscure, off the beaten path books. So I just wanted to let you guys in. This week I've been reading, if you're wondering why I'm talking the way that I'm talking, like crazy person in spaces, it's because I'm reading The Occult Roots of Nazism. I'm almost done. And this book has been a very eye-opening. And if you're smart enough, which I think a lot of our listeners are, you'll be able to kind of tie some parallels in a lot of the things that you see now, sort of numerology and weird magic and religion and
esotericism, yeah.
Yeah, hedonism mixed with it all. Very interesting stuff. But today we're actually going to talk about Happy Victory Day. It's the 80th anniversary of the, we're going to be cringe. I'm sorry, Marat, but it's the 80th anniversary of the victory over fascism.
My grandpa served for the Soviets. You don't need to say sorry to me.
I know, but it's still so cringe. They're like, the victory over fascism. When you say it in the West, it just sounds cringe. I mean, to them, it's like their thing. But I don't know. I hate kind of saying it, but it was a big, big deal. A lot of people came. We're also going to get into the most, I think that in my time, short time, less than a decade as a analyst, the most confusing conflict I've come across is India, Pakistan. So I'm going to leave that segment to Marat. And then Marat and I are both going to try and untie the knots that the American administration has us both in this week. So let's start off with a nice compilation of the Victory Day celebrations.
Thank you.
That was a really good edit by our producer. I'm going to post that on Twitter. That was really, really awesome. Well, many leaders were able to attend Victory Day, as you guys can see through the compilation. Xi was treated as the guest of honor to be seated next to Putin. Lukashenko was obviously already there. He never misses a Russian party. And Burkina Faso's Ibrahim Traore, which is, he's always a really, really excited. Love to see him doing his thing. And here's the complete guest list for you guys that may have not seen it. If you can even read it, it's so long. But quite a few people did show up, and not
see almost a bunch of countries that served in World War II for sure. I see, right?
Yeah, we're going to get to that. We're going to get to that because Trump had a lot to say about that. But most people got there without any problems. But for others, the road to Moscow was anything but smooth. Serbia's Alexander Vucic and Slovakia's Prime Minister Robert Fico. They faced heavy-handed pressure and interference from Western powers trying to block their attendance. So let's take a look at the kind of the timeline. On May 4th, a Slovak Prime Minister, he blasted Zelensky's threats against the Victory Day parade. He called them unprecedented. There was a video. It's quite long, a long statement. But the most important parts is that he calls them completely unacceptable, unadult. He rejected the idea that Ukraine can dictate or intimidate foreign delegations, saying it was very disrespectful. This should have been an invitation for a ceasefire. And interestingly, such a slob, he says, I'm a nobody. I don't matter. But you're threatening Xi. It was so funny. I was like, of course he's like this self-deprecating like slob who's like, it's one thing to threaten me and like Vucic, we don't matter, but they're threatening Xi. I thought that was kind of funny.
Christian hierarchy. So
yeah, I mean, at least he recognizes it, I guess, you know. On May 6th, Fico publicly stated that he was being threatened with punishment for planning to come to Victory Day Parade. And that is the same day that the puppy is eating my plans. That's the same day Poland and Lithuania banned his plane from entering their airspace. The next day, Estonia joined in that blockade, and Fico called it a deliberate attempt to derail. That same day, over 400,000 Slovaks initiated and signed a petition demanding to lift sanctions off Russia. So it seems that they're kind of getting agitated as well, with sort of the EU's picking on their elected leader, who, I don't, if our listeners recall, was also almost assassinated by a pro-Ukrainian fanatic, probably either encouraged at the at best or like paid at worst by these sorts of EU fanatics. On May 8th, Fico departed for Moscow and had to take an alternate route through Hungary, Romania, and Georgia. And he responded by posting a video of himself in the Red Square with Vucic, which I thought was pretty interesting. Nice little slap in the face. They also made sure that they attended all events side by side. Kaya Kallas criticized Fico, of course. He responded by saying, I'm here to defend the Red Army soldiers who died liberating Slovakia. You have no right to dictate sovereign citizens. And then on May 10th is when the two meet face to face, with Putin commenting on his travel.
Уважаемый господин председатель правительства, дорогие друзья, позвольте еще раз поприветствовать вас в Москве. Мы, безусловно, ценим ваше решение приехать на празднование 80-й годовщины победы в Великой Отечественной войне. Мы сейчас только с вами перекинулись несколькими словами. Знаю о сложностях, возникших с прилетом в Москву. Вам чинили такие препятствия логистические, но тем не менее вы здесь, и я думаю, что те, кто пытаются вас сдержать в каких-то ваших планах, лишний раз убедились, что лучше этого не делать. Все равно своей цели вы добиваетесь.
After this, Fico went back on record, released another video stating his flight that should have been 2 hours was now 6 hours due to the EU's actions. And he said that Slovakia does not believe in a military solution, still dedicated to peace. He mentioned that he was able to make productive talks with Russia, China, Brazil, and Vietnam, and stated that he does not accept the EU's assertion that they are developing a new Iron Curtain, stating the Europe needs Russia, and Russia needs Europe, and I extend a hand over this proverbial Iron Curtain. In his closing message, Fico called the visit a massive success and reaffirmed Slovakia's right to conduct an independent foreign policy. Vucic went through the same sort of debacle trying to get to Moscow, though his trip wasn't as hindered. He did make it there earlier than Fico and also released his own statement directly from the Red Square.
Tugo, više od 4 godine nisam bio u Moskvi. Putovao sam danas, čini mi se duže, kako to reče moji prijatelji Milan Knežević, nego što su svoje vremeno Churchill, Roosevelt i Stalin putovali do Jalte. Ali takva su vremena u svetu. Ja sam ponosan na činjenicu što Srbija samostalno i nezavisno donosi svoje odluke. Ponosan na antifašističku borbu srpskog naroda u celini i građana Srbije. I to nikada ne smemo da zaboravimo i nikada ne smemo da dopustimo reviziju te istorije.
What do you mean? I don't like Vucic. Sorry. He kind of annoys me. What do you think of his statement?
Vucic, I wanted to speak on Fico real quick.
Yeah, speak on both, please.
Sorry, I wanted to say how interesting I find the Fico, because this is a bit of a diplomatic win for Russia, because, you know, as you know, this is the through line through the proverbial East and West, and the Czech Republic, Slovakia, Hungary, like this is kind of the border between where the Eastern world and the Western world met. And Slovakia, as you know, in World War II, not quite, the pro-Soviet place. They did have, the local collaborators as well. And so a guy like Fico being so kind of militantly, how do I say it, anti-West, not anti-West, but just like kind of willing to stand up to them. Just find that once again, a little interesting turnaround that Russia was able to pull a rabbit out of a hat. As for Vucic, I wanted to ask you, why is he so controversial in Serbia? Because isn't this like the Serb line?
Isn't he what?
Serbia is pro-Russia. So like, why does he get flack?
From whom? The Serbs?
I see that he's controversial among Serbs as well.
Because Serbs want a strongman leader. They want to vote. They want a Vladimir Putin. They don't want this milquetoast shit Libby. Even if you watch the rest of his statement from the Red Square, he goes on and reasserts. He's like, we are not off of the European path. I promise you. You know, it's like, why do you have to assert that? Like right now from the Red Square, he's kind of like a pushover. They want a strongman moth, you're going to get corruption in the Balkans either way, right? You want strongman corruption. You don't want this like weak-willed, like Vucic type corruption that lets in the French and the Germans. Serbians deserve better than that. They really do after all of their sacrifices.
This is the equilibrium that's like where when you make inroads, in one place, you suddenly are lose sway with another place. And so, as Russia, is able to make gains with certain countries, they have these other milquetoast leaders in place in the others. How much more milquetoast is he compared to the last guy?
I don't even remember the last guy. It feels like it's been Vucic as long as I remember. But there is no opposition. There's no viable opposition. And that's kind of what the conversation that happens every time there's a protest in Serbia or every time, there's a chance that he will be gone or whatever. There's just no real viable opposition. So it's kind of just Vucic.
Sure. Yeah. And that was kind of why I was asking, it seems like that's the case. But then at the same time, it's... you want something better, right?
Serbia is the country that doesn't want to be as important as it is. They're way more important than they want to be. And I can think that that reflects in their government style. They kind of don't take it seriously in this, you know what I mean? Like they're very easy to sort of run over in a diplomatic policy sort of way, because they just don't understand how pivotal they really are. They're very, very important. And I think that they don't want to be that important. They want to be left alone for the most part. Usually, but now we're going to get into your wheelhouse, though, because Pizza and Vucic get all of that flack. But then we had a surprise visit from Nicole Pashinyan, or what does Lucin call him? Pasha something. I don't remember what she calls him. Something Pasha. I don't know. But so he showed up, funnily enough, which was surprising to me, given that he couldn't show up to some of the other negotiations, of which Lukashenko gave him a hard time. I also think that Putin may have been trolling them a little bit, because he seated them next to one another at the victory parade. So it was Lukashenko next to Pashinyan, which I just thought was hilarious. But in stark contrast, and I thought that these relations were turning, and that's why I'm so glad that we're bringing this up with you on. I thought that the relationships were actually going the opposite way. But on May 7th, President, dictator, whatever, Aliyev, what is Deep used to call him? Ilharam Aliyev. Ilharam. Ilharam Aliyev.
Old dad joke.
Of the three brothers, Israel, Azerbaijan, and Turkey. The three brothers. Okay. Sorry, my deep accent.
With the Abraham Accord.
On May 7th, Ilham Aliyev announced that he would not be coming, that he was bailing at the last minute. He said that they have not received an official apology from Russia over the plane crash. They also are holding Russia responsible for cyber attacks that hacked into Azeri or Azerbaijani government websites and posted IRGC imagery, which I'm sorry if that happened. That's hilarious. And they also had some other sort of petty squabbles. So Azerbaijani forces marched in the parade. Armenian forces did not, which is very strange. Why? What do you make of all of that? I want to hand it over to you, maybe to give us some insight on what is going on.
It's crazy because it's like Sudoku trying to figure out all these budding alliances and waning alliances and different axes like that. And I think we might have lost Sarah there. But yeah, I mean, with Aliyev, for example, we hear that, he stays, and on Russian media, I mostly heard that he was staying due to Heydar Aliyev, his late father's birthday. And, that's the birthday every year. So, not really a strong excuse there. But yeah, we also hear this come out that there's some grievances that Azerbaijan has. And this is interesting for me because this actually, which would have seemed unimaginable a few years ago, this is Azerbaijan trying to, tell Russia that they want more respect. They feel aggrieved and they wanted to let them know. So they, didn't come to this. Putin cares about these things, making an appearance. And so I'm sure that he's going to feel slighted by that. But yeah, I mean, to actually come out and say, there's no official apology that we were waiting on. That's also surprising for me on Russia's end, because why not? Why doesn't Russia do that? You would think that Russia, does want to court Azerbaijan at this point, or they've, indicated they will, but they're balking at that. And so then that opens, a door for, the other powers that are trying to court Azerbaijan, for example, Turkey, from influencing them to stay back and try to drive a wedge between Russia and Azerbaijan. Turkey, of course, involved in this as well, because they are involved in the mediation talks with Ukraine. Turkey also involved in the Pakistan and India war. You have Azerbaijan involved in Israel and Gaza because of, so it's just like trying to make sense of who is friends with who, and then who has a contradicting alliance with their other friend. And so it's just like there's always someone who's like left out, right? Like always someone who's has two friends that they need to please and, you know, they can't at the same time. So, yeah, I mean, Azerbaijan, I think, is trying to tell, you know, make a signal to Russia. But ultimately, I still believe that they'll be reined in. I don't think that they're going to, you know, decouple from Russia. But yeah, you know, interesting development. As for Pashinyan, I have to give credit where it's due for him going, because if he didn't go, we would have been like, why, you know, why would you not go? So at least he went there. He probably didn't have any control over the seating chart and, you know, just kind of had to be a good support there. Azerbaijan, I don't even have much commentary as for why Armenia didn't march and Azerbaijan did without their leader there. I saw on the Azerbaijani subreddit, there was a lot of comments, more than I was expecting, of like dismay at the event. And you know, if you don't, in case for those who don't know, the Azerbaijani subreddit is like at least half the users are from Turkey, and so that's probably the sentiment of the Turks. But I mean, that's interesting to me, is it's a very like anti-Russian sentiment. So there that's like that other force within Azerbaijani society is like a pro-Turk and anti-Russian direction. So, yeah, I mean, this is probably, you know, as far as the Caucasus goes, you know, just a minor blip, you know, between Armenia and Azerbaijan. You know, we recently had Pashinyan announce that, or just both states announced that they were getting close to peace talks or, you know, finalizing a deal. Now they've been quote unquote closed for a long time now, but it does seem like that day is coming, is approaching. And of course, you know, Russia is trying to make sure that they're not left out. So now all that is going on. And so everyone's just kind of trying to play nice. And I'm sure Azerbaijan and Armenia both have to do this with Russia. And play ball, but clearly Azerbaijan, you know, with its leverage is flexing its muscles a bit. But as I said, I do expect them to repair their relations.
Good morning, Nick. Or afternoon, I guess, now. And you know what else was funny? Is there was a Victory Day parade in Yerevan, but no Victory Day Baku, I don't think. So maybe they'll all kind of make up their mind. The other star of the show, as usual, is Burkina Faso. Captain Ibrahim Traore of Burkina Faso, at just 36 years old, rapidly emerging, or I guess still emerging, or has established his place as one of the most compelling young leaders on the African continent. Since taking over power in 2022, he has become a central figure in the Sahel and their pushback against colonization and Western influence. He himself has forged a strategic alliance with Russia, which has led to more strategic alliances in the Sahel, as in Mali and Niger. They also started the AES coalition, the Confederation of Sahel States, and exited ECOWAS. He attended the wreath-laying ceremony alongside all of the other leaders, and Putin had this to say to him during their bilateral meetings.
Ваш нынешний визит в Россию на празднование 80-летия Победы весьма символичен и отражает дружественный характер российско-буркинийских отношений. Хотел бы вспомнить также и о вкладе вашей страны в разгром германского нацизма и его сателлитов. Около 30 тысяч жителей нынешней Буркина-Фасо воевали в составе войск антигитлеровской коалиции. В формированиях сражающаяся Франция под руководством легендарного сына французского народа генерала Шарля де Голля.
I didn't know that Burkinabe troops fought in World War. I mean, it makes sense because they were under colonial occupation.
We was World War II soldiers and shit.
You can't do that, though, if they were part of it. Especially if they were forced to fight.
Let it be known then. I mean, yeah, we should honor the Burkina. What was the adjective? Burkinabe?
Burkinabe, yeah, the Burkinabe. Burkinian, but most people don't say Burkinian.
Burkinian sounds actually nicer, but yeah.
You like Burkinian better?
Burkinian or Burkinabe, a contribution to the Allied anti-Hitler effort.
Why do you have to like poo-poo everything? I know it's
no, I'm just that's I love nobody kangs like Russia and the Kremlin.
Well, nobody can when it comes to World War II. I mean, I feel like you lose 30 million people, you've earned the right to kang for at least like a good century.
And you earn the right to kind of have some extra to spare to like give to others, and so that's
well, what that's true. Maybe they're cultivating it to meet it back out.
I think it's great. It helps little countries like this kind of feel at the table. And I'm not even poo-pooing them. Like there was people that served, and that's great. And you know they deserve to honor that. But really, just objectively, it's good for small states like this to have a little bit of national pride.
Yeah, a little morale boost, maybe. Yeah, it's good to be included and have like an actual seat at the table. They did sign a bilateral agreement, which, you know, was more agreements about fighting terrorism in the Sahel, i.e. more Wagner troops to fight AFRICOM, which is just another proxy war of the West versus the East, as simple as it can get. But then we also had a Victory Day ceasefire. We talked about it last week from the 7th until the 10th, announced by Putin. That was basically like, I don't care if you say yes or no, I'm declaring a ceasefire. Never responded to, by the way. We talked about the responses last week, and they were still awaiting a response from Zelensky, which they never received. So no response. So they took that as a silent yes. But Ukraine responded. So there's a government building in Belgorod. Ukraine broke the ceasefire. I believe they said today it's been over 13,000 times, but I can't remember if that's correct. I do know that yesterday they said it was 9,318 ceasefire violations. So let's see what Putin had to say. It's a little bit long, but his speech from yesterday, if you guys haven't seen it, it's only 18 minutes long. It was really good. If you really listen to what he said, not the kanging parts, the words that he used and the things that he was really saying. And after I watched it, I messaged Ari and I said, Putin is pissed. He seems very irritated with the West after that speech. Seemed very, very interesting. So we'll listen to this clip.
В этой связи, несмотря ни на что, предлагаем киевским властям возобновить переговоры, прерванные ими в конце 2022 года. Возобновить прямые переговоры, причем, подчеркну, без всяких предварительных условий. Начать предлагаем без промедления уже в следующий четверг, 15 мая, в Стамбуле, там, где они проводились ранее и там, где они были прерваны. Как известно, турецкие коллеги неоднократно предлагали свои услуги по организации подобных переговоров. И президент Эрдоган очень многое сделал для их организации. Напомню, что эти переговоры, в результате этих переговоров был подготовлен совместный проект документа, и он был парафирован руководителем киевской переговорной группы. Но по настоянию Запада был просто выброшен в корзину. Завтра у нас намечен разговор с президентом Турции, господином Эрдоганом. Я хочу попросить его о том, чтобы он предоставил такую возможность проведения переговоров в Турции. Надеюсь, что он подтвердит свое желание способствовать поиску мира на Украине. Мы настроены на серьезные переговоры с Украиной. Их смысл в том, чтобы устранить первопричины конфликта, выйти на установление долгосрочного, прочного мира на историческую перспективу. Не исключаем, что в ходе этих переговоров удастся договориться и о каких-то новых перемириях, о новом прекращении огня. Причем о реальном перемирии, которое соблюдалось бы не только Россией, но и украинской стороной. было бы первым шагом, повторяю, к долгосрочному устойчивому миру, а не прологом к продолжению вооруженного конфликта после довооружения, доукомплектования ВСУ и лихорадочного рытья окопов и новых опорных пунктов. Кому нужен такой мир? Наше предложение, что называется, на столе. Решение сейчас за украинскими властями и их кураторами, которые, руководствуясь, похоже, своими личными политическими амбициями, а не интересами своих народов, хотят продолжать войну с Россией руками украинских националистов. Повторю, Россия готова к переговорам без всяких предварительных условий.
What's your response to that statement?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like he's, you know, he's had enough. I do feel like something big is coming, like in terms of militarily from Russia. It's just kind of as a right before, you know, right before a negotiation, you know, you do a little punch to the gut. But yeah, I feel like. You heard he mentioned Erdogan there, you know, as I said earlier, you know, Turkey's involved with this Russia-Ukraine thing here. But I, based on how it's going right now and Trump's, you know, response yesterday, I think this war is going to go longer. Recently I thought this war was about to wrap up, but I have a feeling this war, you know, just got prolonged by, I don't know, another year or two.
Thought that it was going to be that long prior to this anyway. I did not think that we were coming to a close, but now I think it's going to be even longer than I thought it was, like maybe 5 to 10 years.
I'm just that long.
Yeah,
I would hope it's not that long, but I really feel like everything has just been prolonged. When you know, at least for me, back in December or whatever, you know, with Trump's election, I thought coming in that this one was going to be, they're going to put a bow on this and try to pivot somewhere else. But yeah, no, this for the both of us looks like it just stretches this out. And as you see from the Xi, the whole the way they rolled out the red carpet for him, this largely is in the broader context a U.S.-China thing, and in kind of Russia is a big chip in the middle that, you know, they'll be vying for.
I like that view instead, that Russia is the chip that they're both fighting over. You know, people were talking about it being more of an on equal footing, and I don't see it that way. I see it the way that you are, is that having Russia in the corner, the United States and China are the near peers, and whoever has Russia kind of sets that other one over, sets you over the edge, is that way that I'm, and India isn't really panning out to be a superpower. And we'll get to that later, but India isn't really panning out to be the superpower it is. And cultivating that allyship isn't the same as cultivating a Russian allyship.
And multipolarity may just be, you know, bipolarity. It may, you know, be sure. The US, China for a while.
Sure. And I'm sorry, I did get a little bit ahead of myself, but we'll just backtrack a little bit. Putin's ceasefire violation speech was in response to Zelensky's girls' night out, aka the meeting of the coalition of the willing. We're getting another coalition of the willing. I am so excited for the new Golden Girls, the new coalition of the willing. We don't have a new George W., but there's the, I think Macron is the new Tony Blair. That, like, Starmer is not the new Tony Blair. It's Macron for sure.
Coalition of the willing sounds like enthusiastic consent a little bit.
Exactly. That's, I think we called Iraq coalition of the willing. So that was on the final day of the ceasefire. Zelensky convened his new coalition of the willing with in Kiev with France, Germany, and the UK. Oh, and Poland, lest they be left out. They unveiled their own ceasefire proposal that will go into effect on May 12th. The UK, Starmer threatened Putin as usual, and here's that.
Yeah. All five leaders here, all the leaders on the meeting we just had with the Coalition of the Willing, an unconditional ceasefire, rejecting Putin's conditions and clear that if he turns his back on peace, we will respond, working with President Trump, with all our partners. We will ramp up sanctions and increase our military aid for Ukraine's defense to pressure Russia back to the table.
And they go on and on in such a fashion. Macron stated that deploying thousands of Western troops to Ukraine was still on the table, while calling the current plan a support contingent to defend strategic infrastructure. Zelensky and friends took to Twitter, as they do, and Telegram. And here's what they have to say. First a 30-day ceasefire, then everything else. Russia should not disguise its desire to continue the war under verbal constructions. A ceasefire is the first step towards ending the war and will confirm Russia's readiness to end the killings. We await a full and lasting ceasefire starting from tomorrow to provide the necessary basis for diplomacy. There is no point in prolonging the killings, and I will be waiting for Putin in Turkey on Thursday personally. I hope that this time the Russians will not look for excuses. I think Turkey said they had no idea that Zelensky was even coming. So
yeah, it's just maddening, because one of the real annoying things about the modern day is the information war, and the strategy in the information war for seemingly everybody is to just lie, CYA, save face, and anyone observing is just hearing every narrative going at once, and everyone's good news going at once, and you don't know what to believe. But I'll get into this with Pakistan and India too. But yeah, I mean, it just drives you mad. Everyone reports that they come back with good news. Everyone's pretending like they're in a strong position, just because it's more beneficial to behave that way. Sure, but this just feels like this will go on and on for the time being. This is not having an insight.
We do have a 1-minute video of Zelensky's demand, so we'll see what condition he's in.
Найголовніший результат – це абсолютно чітка об'єднана позиція щодо наступного. Ми домовилися, що з понеділка, 12 травня, має розпочатися повне і безумовне припинення вогню щонайменше на 30 днів. Ми разом вимагаємо цього від Росії. Ми знаємо, що нас підтримують у цьому Сполучені Штати Америки. Безумовне припинення вогню означає без жодних умов. Спроба висунути будь-які умови є свідченням наміру затягнути війну та зірвати дипломатію. Припинення вогню має бути всеосяжним – повітрі, на морі та на суші. Забезпечити моніторинг припинення вогню цілком можливо у координації зі Сполученими Штатами Америки – це є дійсно реалістичним. Припинення вогню має тримати 30 днів, щоб дати реальний шанс дипломатії. Протягом цього часу робота буде зосереджена на визначенні безпекових політичних гуманітарних основ миру.
Who are they to make any demands of Russia, do you think?
Well, also with the, 10,000 ceasefire violations, can they last? Have they lasted 30 days ever? As far as I know, this was not, honored, of course. As you said, I don't know how often they even ask for ceasefires of that length, but that ceasefire is certainly not coming. But yeah, I mean, once again, this is just a whole bunch of each side, just has their bluster to give, and it's all just kind of posturing for the cameras and for the performance you give, back home through the information war, through the tech. Part of the information war is the narratives for observers and your narratives back home, and it's all just kind of this puppet show we watch. But he's starting to kind of beef up his outfits now. He looks like, I don't know, the Punisher from...
Yeah, it looks a little bit better. Ukrainian has improved a bit. It's still a little clunky, but it's improved.
Yeah, because I understand less of it when he speaks.
Yeah, yeah. It's getting better. He speaks so slow, though. For like to be a fluent speaker, he speaks slow. But yeah, my apologies. I did get ahead of myself. The video I showed you from earlier was actually a response to Ladies' Night at the Coalition of the Willing. The Putin's Victory Day address was after the Coalition of the Willing meeting. I won't replay that video for obvious reasons. And we did discuss the ceasefire violations, but also included in that speech was a call to resume negotiations with Ukraine. He talked about the Istanbul Turkey. That would occur on May 15th. Mm-hmm. He stressed that Russia has never refused dialogue and so on and so forth. I like that he ended with this: there is a war going on and Russia is offering talks. Anyone who wants peace cannot oppose this. I also thought it was funny and important to point out how much he thanked the people for their support, meaning Xi. And he thanked China and especially Xi and stated that he would be going to China for their 80th celebration of the victory over militarist Japan, which is, I think, is pretty significant. The West doesn't put a lot of weight in this kind of thing, but the East really does, especially these civilizational states like China, Russia, Japan, and Iran and India. They're all civilizational states, and they take this much, much, much more seriously. I thought that this segment was another important part to point out. And I think that a lot of it, we read through it last night in one of the spaces, and I was saying, he's trolling. Like listen to what he's saying and how he's saying it. He's trolling.
Рад был лично поблагодарить военачальников Корейской народной армии, передать самые теплые слова солдатам и командирам подразделений спецназа Корейской народно-демократической республики, которые вместе с нашими бойцами профессионально, хочу это подчеркнуть, добросовестно выполняли задачи при освобождении пограничных районов Курской области от формирования киевского режима. Подчеркну, проявили мужество и героизм. Действовали, еще раз это хочу сказать, в высшей степени профессионально, показали хорошую выучку и подготовку.
I thought that was kind of interesting that it was once again for sure to point out that the Koreans were there and fought bravely and they're here. I mean, Putin made a big deal of them coming. He greeted them himself, you know,
he's like one of these Robert De Niro at the end of Raging Bull, when he's bloated and or like he's like these like roast comics, like he loves to like toast to someone and you know or kind of honor someone or celebrate someone. So him in this old age, this is what he does best.
I agree. But in wrapping up with that segment, I do think that this was Putin was obviously miffed that he thought it was a little bit tampered, whatever the word is, by the EU's pettiness and America. He did sarcastically point out in his closing speech, thank you for all of your attention on this conflict. But you could just hear the sarcasm. We appreciate how worried you are about this conflict all of a sudden. But I think that this, all in all, it was a net positive for Russia. I think Putin did a whirlwind of positive publicity for himself. I see just the comments in our chat are just like, wow, you know, he's fantastic. He's my favorite world leader. And, you know, I think it was a good redemption, even though I don't think he meant to use it that way. Maybe I'm simping
last year,
a little bit.
Was it last year when they had the one tank and they were having to, you know, tighten the belt and things were looking bleak? And, you know, you make a certain big turnaround within a year. And the other difference from, you know, years past is no Western leaders at all invited anymore, right? Like not in the past, there used to be, because this was, a World War II victory. But now it's like they were fought for the other side.
Well, I mean, was it you that I was talking? It might have been Mercury. I don't remember. But I was talking to you about how, like, it really is and how we kind of, I don't know if I'm ready to say the hot takes yet because I'm not, like confident in this. But, we sided with the Nazis and when they were going up against Russia. So it's not that far-fetched that, you know, we kind of just popped in at the last minute and we're like, let's take the spoils. But we're going to get, I shouldn't spoil that. We're going to get to that in the last segment. So let me get this segment out of the way, which I am not looking forward to. But I'll just say, India, Pakistan, I know that there was an Operation Sindoor and an Operation Bunyan al-Marxis. And then that's it. Marat, go ahead. Then take it away. I have no idea what is happening in this conflict. I can't get heads or tails out of any of the commenters that I would, or commentators that I would think I could. And lies and the information war has been the most psychotic that I've ever seen.
Well, like the little baby in Central Sea song, they're going band for band in India and Pakistan. We see them exchanging strikes this past week. So on Monday, India had conducted some missile strikes targeting 9 alleged terrorist camps in Pakistan and Pakistan-administered Kashmir, linking them to the the April 22nd terrorist attack. But Pakistan retaliated later on, reporting 31 civilian deaths, including 12 children, alleging strikes hit civilian areas. Pakistan reported 31 civilian deaths on their side, and alleged strikes hit civilian areas like mosques. Pakistan launches drones and missiles at the Indian military targets along the line of control, and claims to down 25 Indian drones and 5 aircraft. So there's this competing narratives from India and Pakistan, where they each say they have competing numbers for what their side each accomplished. And they go back to, as they report to, you know, their home domestic base, they were able to kind of say face and to flex. The skirmishes persist, and this continues until the just 1 second. So the skirmishes persist, and as the weekend hits, you know, we have J.D. Vance and Trump initially kind of being hands off, right? We have Trump, and I had a link here on the clip, but when they asked Trump about it, you know, he essentially is just like, yeah, you know, you hate to hear about it, you hate to hear what's going on, you know. So he basically gives a non-answer. J.D. Vance gives an interview and he says, we're not going to do it in front of our business, right? And things change by the weekend. And then we see the news that the U.S. Is now mediating talks, right? Why do you think they got the U.S. involved?
Well, now, wait. So I thought that they weren't. After Trump took credit for the ceasefire, they came out and said they're not involved.
Well, why? I'm saying this is kind of a rhetorical question, but why do you think the U.S., after saying it's none of our business, suddenly, you know, overnight is making phone calls?
They want to take credit for it. They need a win. They are losing Russia.
So that's definitely a factor. I do think Trump is chasing a Nobel Peace Prize.
This is an inevitable ceasefire, right? They're not going to go into full-blown war right now. The best, at worst, they're going to stop. They're going to put it on the back burner, rearm, regroup, and go at it. At best, this is it. They've, you know, India's already kind of opened up some of the water. This is why, another reason why this has been so confusing for me is that, you know, we had 2 days where most Pakistanis and Pakistani media were all claiming like, we won the war. And I was like, there was a war. And you know, it looks like India kind of tore it up. They did pretty well for being that long out of practice. And I think that this is an inevitable ceasefire and Trump and team understand that. And they're like, well, we can get in and say we had a hand in it. We need a win. We're the no war. They're supposed to be the no war administration and they can't stop a war.
I hope you're right. But some speculate that there was a threat of a nuclear retaliation. And that's why the U.S. in the 11th hour did suddenly get a bit more involved too. Because if you saw some of the interviews, some of the Pakistani generals, they they're talking scary, like in terms of like, you know, we're going to go out in a blaze of glory if we're going out. So stuff like that, you know, doesn't inspire confidence. And so, you know, hopefully that's not the case. But yeah, I was just curious if you thought that intel had signified that. But yeah, so for whatever reason, you know, after a difficult week, and we had already seen after Operation Sindoor, you know, we have India suspending the Indus Water Treaty. Pakistan withdraws from the Simla Agreement. So both of the existing bilateral agreements are, you know, tossed aside. And, you know, we still had seen kind of this hands-off approach. And then finally in the over the weekend, we hear that there is an agreement or a ceasefire. And, you know, Trump tweets about it. And we saw Trump's tweet. You know, once again, in true Trump fashion, patting himself on the back. And I'm glad, as you mentioned, this is a common theme here, whether it's Ukraine, Russia, and Pakistan, India, or Gaza, Israel. I really think he wants this Nobel Peace Prize, kind of like when an athlete like is chasing an MVP award and their teammates are just like feeding them the ball. And it's just like cringy thing you're watching. But yeah, I really think Trump is dead set on getting this Nobel Peace Prize. And so he's trying to just have his footprint everywhere. And you know, we see that with a tweet, which once again, you know, just a few hours after that, well, the ceasefire is crumpled up, and we see more strikes. And for now, the situation is still tentative, and we will keep an eye on it. I do agree with you. I don't think nuclear war is like imminent, but are threats being made? You know, who knows anymore? The amount of people I see that are open to nuclear war is certainly more than I would have guessed there'd be. So.
Well, there's people that think we already hit each other with nukes now and that we just survive it. So,
I mean, don't you think so? Like, aren't there like a shocking number of people that are open to nuclear war?
Yeah. But there's a shocking number of people who think that we're bombing people with nukes right now. So they think like, if we can survive those nukes, what's nuclear war? And I'm sorry to our subcontinent bros. You won't be seeing us because we got. We are being withheld in India, which I, you know, the only reason why I'm touching on this is A, because it's funny, and B, because India releases an 8,000 name list to Elon and he clears it, ban, done. Brazil does it, and instead he makes posts about how Lula's a dictator. Like, it's just, it's so funny. It's so, I need to point these things out to people that like X is such a political manipulation tool, like out in the open. It's just, it's really.
The inbox will get a reprieve.
India. Well, you know what? We weren't critical of India at all. We were very neutral. We probably lean more towards India than Pakistan.
I didn't mean those kind of DMs.
Oh. But yeah, we didn't really. I guess they just don't want anybody telling anything. And I mean, I understand that. I can kind of understand that to a degree.
A lot of pull on X. I noticed that.
India does?
Yeah.
Oh yeah. There are just so many that they just don't stop coming.
Yeah.
It's like the White Walker from Game of Thrones when they're just coming over the wall. That's how comment sections are on Twitter with Indians.
That's right.
Well, anyway. So
the other sorry, go ahead.
I'm going to wrap up that segment if we can.
Sorry, I had one more thing. Was that the other thing that this exposes or this conflict is that through this whole complicated web, as I call it, like a Sudoku puzzle, the engagement in South Asia is very shallow. This is kind of just exposing the fact that there is no instrument for mediation here. No one seems to have the right sway. It seems like China is working its way in as being a power player here. You know, we know about their relations with Pakistan. And then India is, you know, historically, and seems like to this day,
non-aligned, right? And so there, this is one region where we don't really have, this is kind of a new territory for us for how we mediate this. And
the UN was thousands of years.
Yeah, of course. The UN is marginalized as well. The UN ineffectiveness here. I mean, that's, you know.
You think Israel for that? Israel and Russia?
Right, exactly. And so, we'll see whether it's, whether China is the big power broker here or what they do. The word on the street is that they benefit the most from this whole thing, right? And so be interesting to keep an eye on how they navigate it.
Yeah, I'll just sit back and watch because I have no idea. But in other really big news, speaking of having difficulties navigating, but Trump made friends with the Houthis this week, Ansarallah. So on May 6th, the United States and Israeli forces were bombing the hell out of Sana'a International, completely destroyed it. But that same day, another F-18 mysteriously fell off of the Truman. I mean, I've done a deployment. I did 7 months on the Ike. Sorry, I also deployed on the Stennis. We never had a jet just fall off the boat in turns, in rough seas. And to have two fall off the boat? Wow. That sounds like things are getting shot down. Just saying. Trump publicly announced a ceasefire. I think I posted that video on the big account. We will take their word. They said they will not be blowing up ships anymore. Oman's foreign ministry said neither side will target the other, including American vessels in the Red Sea and Bab al-Mandeb Strait. Leader of Ansarallah said, "We indirectly informed the Americans that the continued escalation will affect the criminal Trump's visit to the region, and we have informed them of nothing else." So I guess that's the other ceasefire Trump's taking credit for. It doesn't sound very positive. I mean, I'm guessing that they're saying like, oh, we'll stop like messing around while you're like doing your little tour. But after that, I mean, and then they bombed Israel the same day, I think.
So, I mean, this is like nothing matters anymore. Like you can just say black is white and just post it. And this is what our leaders do. Does it matter? I mean, like the game is that, you know, you have an online army that's going to boost what you say anyway. So it's
odd. We've been talking about that. The idea of like social manufacturing, social engineering, and truth manufacturing, the manufacturing of truth. If you have more people that believe the sky is green than the people that believe the sky is blue, the norm is now that the sky is green.
And not even manufacturing consent anymore, but just manufacturing truth.
Yeah, just making up the truth. And if they don't have like physical people that agree with them, they'll just hire bots.
Right, yeah.
NBC did report this week that Operation Rough Rider, every time that I read it, I have to Rough Rider, like every single time it doesn't fail. But Operation Rough Rider cost the United States over $1 billion in 2 months. Where the hell is Doge? $775 million in munitions alone and 22 MQ-9 Reapers. That's another $700 million. So really, really doing good. We don't know however much the jets cost that are just plopping off of boats. Plus the ship that ran aground. That was another one that was very interesting. The Iran talks are back on, but not in a nice way. That's another interesting one. They're like, we'll talk to you, but we're already making the demands. They're going to start again in Oman this weekend. This is the fourth round of discussion. It'll be Witkoff and the foreign ministry of Iran. They've reiterated that they will not relinquish their nuclear rights regarding uranium enrichment capabilities, and they are non-negotiable. While Steve Witkoff reiterated that Iran must dismantle its U.S. or uranium enrichment facilities and ship nuclear material abroad. President Trump issued a stern warning to Iran, stating that the U.S. could blow them up nicely or blow them up viciously if Iran doesn't comply with dismantling their nuclear sites. This sounds like a setup, and we're going to continue in a minute and talk about more evidence why this sounds like a setup. These talks sound like they are doomed to fail.
Well, they do, because, you know, ultimately, I don't think the U.S. is going to snub Israel. But the interesting thing is that the way that this, you know, upcoming tour and all this shakes out is that the U.S. is warming its relations, you know, with these Gulf states, and they're going to kind of. This trip will is kind of meant to highlight this the pivot towards, you know, the Gulf as the proxies in the Middle East for us, and so this in a way kind of puts them, you know, at odds with Israel. But, you know, as for Iran, I mean, the Iran talks, I know Trump wants them. Once again, this is something that, like, where it's like, is this U.S. interests or his personal interests, right? And so I think for his personal interests, he wants these talks. More than the establishment wants anything done from the point of view of the American war lobby, right? But you think there's not going to be any Iran deal?
I don't know. They just sound doomed to fail. Iran sounds very, you ripped up the JCPOA. I'm not negotiating on uranium enrichment again. That's it. And I think that they're more so a little bit of chicken is being played here. Like, you won't bomb my nuclear sites. Like, and we're going to continue on in a little bit just because, or on right now in the same vein, because, you know, now we're getting a lot of these rumors that people are saying Trump's falling out of friendship with Bibi. They're finally turning their back on Israel. They're listening to the base. And I really want your opinion, but I want to go through some of the evidence that I kind of compiled, because I started off not believing it. And I always like to play devil's advocate with myself. Hell yes, it is. Kosovo is Serbia, as always. The Bosnians in the chat can cry. Anyway, so there is an overall shift, generally speaking, and everybody has been celebrating. I'm still a cynic. Pew Research put out recently, negative views of Israel have risen exponentially. As of 2025, Pew Research finds, for the first time, slight majority, 53%, hold an unfavorable view of Israel. In March 2022, unfavorable opinions stood at 42%. So that's 11 points in 3 years. And more strikingly, though, those with a very unfavorable opinion doubled from 10% to high 19%. So that's pretty significant. We're seeing a big shift in the overall population. This week as well, and she's been railing for a while, Marjorie Taylor Greene, who shouted us out on the House floor once again. Thank you, Marjorie Taylor Greene, Marge, Maggie, whatever you like to be called. Well, she issued a statement on X, which I have right here. It's very long. I represent the base, and when I'm frustrated and upset over the direction of things, you better be clear. The base is not happy. I campaigned for no more foreign wars, and now we are supposedly on the verge of going to war with Iran. I don't think we should be bombing foreign countries on behalf of other foreign countries, especially when they have their own nuclear weapons and massive military strength. And on top of that, now we are told we have signed a deal for mineral rights in Ukraine in order to pay us back for the hundreds of billions of dollars that we gave Ukraine and they used for money laundering, sold the weapons we gave them to our enemies, and their leader is a dictator who canceled elections, was involved in the first impeachment of Trump, and campaigned for Biden. She goes on and on and on to say wondering about Doge, talks about Ukraine, also mentions COVID, and at the end she says, when you are losing MTG, you are losing the base. And Trump isn't on the ballot in the future. So do the math on that. Do the math. This isn't the first time that she's kind of come out. She also came out, and was it, can't even, all the weeks blend together. She came out before the bill hit the floor. We talked about it last week. She said, I will be voting no on this bill. She's taking a very strong stance. I'm wondering kind of if she's playing mouse lip service. Although MTG does just generally hold these opinions. She's very much an isolationist, very, very, very true to a America first. Do you have any thoughts on Marjorie Taylor Greene before I move on to the bromance?
Pay lip service to that. I think the rhetoric itself, like just the kind of exaggerated style that she uses, I think that's mostly just that plays to her base. I think it's just it's good red meat for her base to always pretend like, you know, the neocon lobby always has us on the cusp of, you know, another big war. And so, you know, for her, that just, you know, strengthens her position in Congress. But for the Iran talks, I was more optimistic a couple weeks ago when we first spoke on it, when, you know, the upcoming deadline coming up. As the weeks have gone by, I also have, I'm pessimistic now. It doesn't seem like there's going to be anything, and these are probably dead on arrival.
All right. Well, then let's keep going with the evidence I've compiled. So then we have Trump cuts ties with Netanyahu. I don't remember what day this came out, but it did come across first IDF wire, where that's where I first saw it. And now White House sources have corroborated, and they've spoken to Axios and Haaretz, saying that Trump has not returned Bibi's phone calls over a week. They said that Trump was furious after learning that Netanyahu attempted to sabotage the U.S. Houthi ceasefire agreement brokered via Oman. Trump reportedly views Bibi as having used up his capital in Washington, particularly among Republican voters. Excuse me. Keep in mind that this does come just a few days after Waltz was dismissed for allegedly having a backdoor, no pun intended, open to Israel. So there's that. We have, but again, that's kind of a nothing burger. It's kind of like all the lines of communication are still open. You just don't want to talk to Bibi. So
tactical, I feel like.
Well, that was the first indication that I was like, either he's distancing himself from some terrible decision that Bibi's about to make, or they're saying that we don't like this government, but another one might do. That's what my initial two thoughts were. Then we have the article come out from Thomas Friedman, of all people. The Israeli government is not our ally. He pointed out specifically that Trump decided not to skip Israel entirely up on his upcoming Middle East tour. His engagement with the Saudis, he is engaging with the Saudis, Qataris, and Emiratis, and completely leaving Netanyahu out. He also made the case that Netanyahu is undermining decades of U.S. foreign policy in the region, arguing that the current Israeli government prioritizes annexation and ethnic cleansing over peace and diplomacy. And he kind of goes on and calls them he says this ultranationalist messianic Israeli government is not America's ally. Netanyahu did think he could make you his chump, but this time you've signaled you're not his patsy. So Thomas Friedman, but then he made sure every time he talked about it, he pointed out he was speaking about the current Israeli government, not the state of Israel. The state of Israel isn't carrying out a genocide, according to Thomas Friedman. This current Israeli government is.
I think there's been a tipping point reached where even people that are, pro-Zionist are realizing the harm that Bibi's causing onto, you know, Israel's longevity. And so I think this is, you know, people, you know, like Friedman and some other voices through the week that I've heard recently that are kind of more open to, Bibi's overstepped. You know, he had to be shown, you know, put in his place. And, so I do think that there's a tide turning on Bibi and people realizing that, okay, like if I want to, you know, if I want the best for Israel, I want this guy gone, you know, let alone if I'm pro-Palestine, excuse me. What do you think?
I think that it was a threat to Bibi. change course or we're going to get rid of you.
Yeah.
Like there, this, he's like you mentioned, he wasn't the only one this week to express his disdain or kind of being fed up with the current Israeli government, the far right, ultra nationalists, messianic, you know, they're fanatics. If we could just get a nice, this is liberal Zionism. If we could just get a nicer or left wing Zionism, nicer coalition in the Knesset, it wouldn't be so bad.
Not to mention with the polling, this is a moment where he would have public support. This won't be an unpopular move to be more, you know, to stand up to Israel. So this is something the public is looking for. So there's, you know, a demand on one end, and he probably sees the, you know, his own personal interest here, because, you know, as we said, he wants the you know, the kind of pomp and circumstance of the doing a peace treaty, a Nobel Peace Prize, blah, blah, blah. You know, there's that personal interest for him, but there's this great timing to fix our course between the U.S. and Israel relations. There's no better time than now. I mean, it's probably, I don't know when Israel's been as unpopular as it is today.
Now I'm going to take my minute to yell at everybody, okay? Stop doing this shit. Jerusalem, these headlines, they come out and people go absolutely nuts. Donald Trump to announce U.S. Recognizes Palestinian state, Gulf diplomatic source claims. I mean, the answer's in the headline, but I know you probably didn't even read the whole headline. You read to the comma and then stopped. You probably didn't even read the source where it was from, the Jerusalem Post. You spent 2 years discrediting everything that came out of Israel only to use the Jerusalem Post as a source. But that's neither here nor there. They don't even read the articles that go along with it. I have everybody and their mothers talking about Trump's about to recognize a Palestinian state on his Middle Eastern world tour. And nobody stops to think that that just sounds psychotic. Okay. They didn't stop to read the article. So let's read the article together. This is the only chunk that says that in the whole thing. A Gulf diplomatic source who declined to be named or disclose his position told the media line, who? From where, with what qualifications is saying this? And everybody just eats it up and goes nuts. And then we have to spend a day explaining to them why they're stupid for getting their hopes up and reporting that this is like even in the realm of possibility. Did you notice this? This was something that like you kind of seemed busy yesterday, but this is something that like took off like wildfire. As soon as I saw the headline, I said, oh dear, here we go.
Well, I mean, you know who my Gulf source is? It's my Saudi mechanic. he doesn't have to disclose his position or his name, right? Yeah, I mean, once again, we come back to it. This will be a common theme, is the information war. It's just the, you know, you, and this is posted with that intent, knowing people won't read the article or, you know, the end of the headline. This is all just kind of meant to kind of confuse and misdirect, but the source, I mean, this really just is just kind of to placate the Saudis, right? In terms of the upcoming deal. I mean, this kind of just gives some red meat to their base. This kind of, you know, throws it out there, you know, that that to give the illusion that this is kind of in the works, but you and I agree, right? That this is just kind of tossed out there as red herring.
Why? I mean, I agree, but like, why? Like, it just seems like stupid. Like, it really does. It's like, it's not even a red herring. It's like a shiny object that they just throw and like hope that a bunch of people are going to chase it. And they do. You know, all these crazy pro-Palestine people with the triangles in their name are like, he's going to do it. He's finally going to do it. It's changing. And you're like, get out of the echo chamber. This is never going to happen.
So, that speaks to what I was saying, was that like, because they know that's going to get that reaction, this also speaks to Trump's foreign policy may just be so chaotic and jumbled and so many different things said at once that someone was like, I feel like I heard something that gives me enough to say this. And, you know, this will just be a great thing to throw out there. I really do think that like that that's part of it. Is this like whoever's running it is probably just promising a lot of things, saying a lot of things, and a whole lot of bluster going around. And
sure. And then I think the article goes on to state something like they'll discuss Palestine. Nobody said anything about that, but people don't read the article. They just read what some random influencer posts on X, and then that's it. Some anti-Israel poster, you know, they must be right. But this is all in reference to Trump's upcoming Middle East tour. So I mentioned that he would be going there. He is touring the Gulf. I don't know if Israel was ever even in the itinerary. They might just be saying they're cut out of it. I'm not sure that they were ever in it, but they were absent from it. But I think the more important part of this is, which also lends more evidence to your side, Murat, is that this is all just lip service and nonsense, is that Jared Kushner is actually coaching them all as their lead up into their Middle East tour. So as we looked into last night, we were talking about it. Abraham Accords built in, or well, Jared Kushner was the main architect of those. And just for our listeners, the Abraham Accords were an agreement that was meant to usurp and replace the 2002 Arab Peace Initiative, I believe it was, Arab Peace Initiative. And that that initiative had normalization with Israel was hinged on the recognition of this Palestinian state. So the Abraham Accords actually took that caveat out of it and said, you can just normalize with Israel. And UAE and Bahrain went ahead and did that. And Qatar and Saudi did not. And so the goal of this trip is to get those other guys on board and expand the Abraham Accords. It has nothing to do with
Palestinian statehood.
And they're trying to get them away from that being a point of contention.
And also, who else is a part of this effort here for the Abraham Accords, none other than Azerbaijan? So there's a new effort to integrate Azerbaijan into the Abraham Accords.
Why? They're not Arab.
Well, they're part of this Israel, Turkey, U.S., Azerbaijan axis. And so
it's going to get worse.
Once again, this complicated alliance network, which has competing loyalties, but everyone's trying to entrench themselves, in the right places. And so Azerbaijan is one of these places where people want to build, some sort of a diplomatic relation. And so, I do believe I saw that Azerbaijan is one of the nations that they're trying to work out for the Abraham Accords. Now, if you remember last week, you had asked me about Bibi's trip to Baku that got canceled.
Right? Yeah.
It's all related. Like, there's all these power brokers that are competing for each other.
We're gonna have to get the red yarn now and do that. We'll have to.
Well, Aliyev doesn't go to Moscow. Netanyahu doesn't go to Baku. Everyone's just telling each other like,
right. And now maybe this is a good point to address something. And I don't mean to get us off track, but I wanted to ask you, even though it's corny, I don't care. Trump and Bibi exchanged very nice pleasantries before Victory Day. And during Putin's Victory Day speech, he did say that they need to fight against anti-Semitism. I also want to stress to our Western listeners that anti-Semitism in Russia is not chanting at Columbia University. It's a completely different thing. So when he says he's going to fight anti-Semitism, he means literal Nazis, because Nazism is illegal in Russia. But anyway, they did exchange pleasantries. What do you make of people getting kind of leery about Trump and Bibi? And how do we reconcile with the fact that the Victory Day parade is supposed to be a celebration? I mean, they tell us it's a celebration of the victory over fascism and Zionism. I can't think of a better example of fascism in existence today.
Yeah, I mean, Trump and Bibi will be fine. I think that they, there's this is, as we said, going to be some public posturing, but ultimately Trump and Bibi are, you know, there's not going to be a love lost there. For Zionism, this is just kind of how ideology evolves, right? And Zionism, you know, being a Jewish nationalism, you know, we see Jews have their own nativism and nationalism that, you know, can turn toxic in the same way that had, you know, they were had received the brunt of. And, you know, Zionism and Nazism, the Zionism and, you know, kind of anti-Semitism and, you know, these forces that we saw there, Nazism, one similarity between them, you know, in a sense, you know, and kind of how things cycle through is this sort of eschatology, right? Like when you kind of believe your own narrative and kind of welcome the end, or you already have this sense of understanding how the end is going to come, it's a little apocalyptic, right? And so this regime currently in Israel, we do hope that there comes a resolution in a way that doesn't require, you know, just all out war that has to remove them. You know, hopefully that they could just, you know, correct course, and it doesn't have to end in a bunker, right? But the people get confused as to like, okay, well, you know, Jews were in this position in one point and they're in this other position in another, and it's always relative, right? Like it's all a matter of, you know, the context of power, and, you know, who has the upper hand in what particular conflict, and which ideology is nativist or nationalist to a particular area. But this will probably be studied in history, you know, kind of the development of Zionism out of the Holocaust and into this nation state of Israel, and then this other ethnic conflict that came as a result of that.
We're wrapping up, but I do want to include some stories from today. Laura Loomer is going insane. You know what? If you guys don't follow Laura Loomer, you guys can hate all you want. I have gotten more breaking stories from Laura Loomer that I could then go like research myself and find out that it mattered than any other influencer I think I could think of. Well, anyway, I found it from her because she's absolutely fuming that the Qataris would give Trump anything because the Qatari lobby is growing in power tremendously. And Pam Bondi, who Laura Loomer is in a war with online, was a former a registered foreign Qatari lobbyist who was paid $150,000 a month. So Laura Loomer is fuming. Trump will be accepting a Boeing 747 TAC-8 from the Qatari royal family to serve as Air Force One. This is a $400 million luxury jet supposed to be retrofitted by L3 Harris, which is in Texas, I believe. And then the kicker is that when he leaves office, he gets to keep it.
Wow.
He gets to keep it. So he gets to keep it. Not only will he be using our funds and the Air Force, because the Air Force has to retrofit Air Force One because it's part of the Air Force. So he's using our tax dollars. He's going to keep it and just take it. It's going into the presidential library, he said.
So is this a new, we have these presidential bribes where we kind of have these special gifts that they have?
Okay, because it's a gift to the administration in the interim.
That's crazy.
Isn't it?
That's crazy. Has a president gotten to keep anything of that size?
That'll be the largest gift ever given.
That's crazy. Interesting. We'll see what else they give.
I want to see the inside, though. It's got like a penthouse in it. No joke. It has a penthouse inside the plane.
They and probably have a golden cockpit.
One last thing I want to cover is Trump's response to all the crap we said today between Zelensky and Putin, and Zelensky again. President Putin of Russia doesn't want to have a ceasefire agreement with Ukraine, but rather wants to meet on Thursday in Turkey to negotiate a possible end to the bloodbath. Ukraine should agree to this immediately. At least they will be able to determine whether or not a deal is possible. And if it is not, European leaders and the U.S. will know where everything stands and can proceed accordingly. I'm starting to doubt that Ukraine will make a deal with Putin, who's too busy celebrating the victory of World War II, which could not have been won, not even close, without the United States of America. Have the meeting now. My Trump imitation's getting better. Not even close.
It's getting repetitive at this point. It's just like we say the same thing over and over again.
It's so funny because last week on the show, we were literally talking about Trump saying, "I don't think Putin wants a deal."
Yeah.
And now he's saying, "Please take the meeting. Take the meeting, Zelensky." In one way. Well,
he's also just like, let me riff this one. He's doing just like freestyle dissing, where he's like, which, by the way, would not have been won with the U.S. Like,
not even close.
Stream of consciousness. Yeah.
I do love that. Like, just ending on that note. But I do want to wrap. We took it way over 90 minutes today, and my Trump imitation is getting better. Thank you, everyone, for joining. And Murat, do you have any closing?
Checking the time, yeah, I was like, are we half hour in or 90 minutes in? I was
like, no, we went way over. I'm sorry, guys. And thank you. You took us to almost 6,000 live viewers, which is incredible as the weather warms up. Thanks, everyone, for watching. Don't forget this episode, as well as all the episodes from our newest podcast called Not One Step Back, which is really cool. I don't even think Timmy knew this. So Timmy's doing a podcast called Not One Step Back, which, if our listeners don't know, is an homage or a nod to Joseph Stalin. We believe the Battle of Stalingrad, might be Leningrad, not sure. But there was an edict that came out as a Not One Step Back. But anyway, her first episode with Scott Camille, I haven't listened to the episode yet, but I went to go watch a documentary on Netflix, and it turns out Scott is one of the stars in the documentary. It is the documentary Turning Point, Vietnam War. So if you guys have watched that documentary, Scott did an episode, the pilot episode of Timmy's new podcast, which is our channel on Spotify. So if you guys get a second, please listen to that and rate it. Don't forget, you can support us by subscribing to us on YouTube, Substack, or X, or directly on ddgeopolitics.com. Murat, you want to say goodbye, and we'll see you guys next week.